Hi, and welcome to the latest edition of Consilio's Better Places podcast. Today, I am joined by Sean Simmons from Compton.
And thank you for having me.
No problem at all. And Sean, I see the cameras here, and I think, given your high profile, which you have on social media, when is the Netflix series going to start? I've just finished the Sirhan programme in Manhattan, and I'm thinking London needs something like that.
Joe, what we've really wanted to do something for years. We've had different production companies come in to see us, and there's been an interest in doing it from a production standpoint. There's been an interest from us to do it from a, well, why wouldn't you want to do
it? Indeed, yeah.
I just feel that in the commercial real estate world, when you're dealing with institutional businesses, people listed on the stock market, even private businesses with confidentiality around it, in the residential world, it's a lot easier to execute. You effectively, if someone's buying a house, can we film you? It's a yes or no answer. And if it's yes, you kind of follow the journey. But in the commercial world, it's riddled with nuance. So I don't think there's going to be a Netflix show coming out soon. If we could find a way around it, I think there is some incredible content, not only Compton content to create, but I think the whole commercial property world, and I'm talking about all different scenarios, whether it's the planning, whether it's someone looking to buy an office, to lease an office, a business who's going through unbelievable scale. I think there's so many interesting storylines to pick up from that kind of show. I just think it's a really difficult thing to execute.
Yeah.
So I think there's a number of tenants. Hold your breath.
Yeah, a number of tenants might be quite interested in that, mightn't they? But the investors and it.
I think they would. But listen, I think there are some really good shows and there's some not so good shows. And I feel that the ones that are overproduced, they don't quite hit the mark. And I think that's kind of the problem.
Yeah.
Don't hold your breath, because I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, in that case, it won't. But for those who are watching and listening who aren't aware of yourself and Compton, you specialise in the City Fringe and commercial. Do you just want to explain a bit about the City Fringe is?
So, broadly speaking, Compton is our second business. So, just by way of really quick background, I started in the real estate industry at 16, left school, failed my GCSEs, didn't get any A-levels, didn't go to university, kind of went into the big wide world of commercial real estate from the age of 16. Navigated through a few jobs for probably 9 or 10 years, and then I set up my first business called Hatton Real Estate in 2010. We sold that business to Colliers International in 2016, and we reformed as Compton in 2021. When I talk about Compton, I can talk about Compton and Hatton in the same vein, because kind of Hatton was the iPhone 1, and I think Compton is the iPhone 10.
Was Hatton because of Hatton Gardens? Is it that area you were specialising in?
Well, myself and my partners all met. We all met on Hatton Garden. Okay. It just kind of felt correct. But they're kind of the same, or the principles are the same. Compton is just a more modern version of what Hatton was. But effectively, in 2010, we looked at the market and we felt that it was kind of full of, it was like the old boys club. It was all middle-aged white men in pinstripe suits that all did their dealings together. Everything was quite insulated. And we were working in a vibrant, innovative, creative part of the London market. And we just felt there was an opportunity to kind of mix things up and kind of make things a bit sexier. So we were kind of the first agents at Hatton to be using the likes of Twitter at the time and YouTube from our mainstream marketing. We were the first agents to be doing video productions. I mean, they were awful at the time, looking back on them. But at the time, we were the first ones to be doing it. Yeah. So really, Compton is a kind of an evolved version of that, in the same way that you got, using the iPhone analogy, you got the iPhone 1 and the iPhone 10, or the iPhone 10 and the iPhone 16. They principally do the same thing. They make calls, they send messages, you can go on the internet with them, you can take photos. Hatton and Compton were the same things, I think, but Compton is just a more slicker, more powerful, larger version.
So how do you make commercial real estate sexy?
Very good question. Now, commercial property should be sexy. For years, it wasn't. Now, most people, and we won't get onto the work from home debate, hopefully, but we might get onto a little bit of it, but you spend more time in your office, typically, than you do in your home. I mean, I do anyway. Yep. I mean, by a country mile.
Yep.
And I just feel offices, I just feel it's never really had, I guess, the exposure or the gravitas. I mean, and this all flows through. It's not just in terms of how they're refurbished, but it's about how they're branded, what they culturally mean for a business who occupies it, what about the community around it. And I think there's a much bigger picture around the commercial real estate world than it's just a place you go to work. And part of what we've been trying to do as Compton is not only brand these buildings correctly, but kind of engage with the consumer. And rather than it just be an office where you go to work, it's about kind of storytelling and making these things a lot more desirable than perhaps they were when they were marketed a decade ago.
So what makes the City Fringe different?
So the City Fringe, going back to your original question. So the City Fringe is well, it was always kind of the armpit.
Is it like Walthamstow Village? It just keeps growing and growing and growing in estate agent terms, or is it a defined area?
The boundaries do keep moving, but in a really kind of high level view, it's kind of Clarkham or Farringdon as one pocket, Old Street Shoreditch as another, Aldgate Whitechapel as another. Then if you go north, King's Cross, Islington, Highbury, Camden as that northern eastern fringe, and then Hackney. Which is,
and each, I presume, has its own distinct narrative to it. I mean, Crossrail must be changing Farringdon, Google must be changing King's Cross, and so on.
Yeah, listen, especially at the moment, not only does every district have its own narrative, but actually, the way the market is at the moment, every building kind of has its own narrative. So, if you'd have called me pre-COVID and say, "How's the Farringdon market doing?" I'd be able to tell you, because you could kind of brush it all with kind of one. With one opinion. Today, that's not the case. And that's just a shift in dynamics of the market in the wake of COVID, in the wake of political uncertainty, in the wake of ridiculous planning policy. So, yeah. So that is our area of expertise.
Okay. And is it the tech industry? That would be the lazy stereotype view of what's an occupier in Shoreditch, say, you know, you're picturing the tech world.
So, well, within that, within the City Fringe market, we effectively have a number of different service lines on the brokerage side. So we do office leasing, we do tenant representation where we act for occupiers, serviced office brokerage and capital markets. We then have three other service lines. We have Compton Studio, which is a marketing business. We have Compton Concierge, which is a facilities management business. And we have Compton Rates, which is a rates advisory business. And it's all really focused around the Eastern City Fringe. And in answer to your question, listen, again, pre-COVID, 70% of the business we were transacting in the Eastern City Fringes were to technology-based businesses. In the same way that the property market adopted Hanover Square and Mayfair in the 60s and 70s as their destination, the same happened with the tech market and the City Fringe. Now, that is not the case at the moment, due to lots of different factors.
So what is it now then, if it's not tech?
It's kind of reversed back to what it was pre the tech explosion, which is, it's really kind of, it's a bit of everything. I mean, depending on which district, but if you look at things like Aldgate, Whitechapel, there's a real kind of focus around here around charitable organisations, education occupiers. If you go into Shoreditch and Old Street, you've still got a lot of tech happening, not as much as previously, but a lot of it, kind of creative industries, fashion, media, so on and so forth. Interestingly, Clarkham and Farringdon has kind of evolved a lot. It's kind of become an extension of the West End rather than a part of the City Fringe. Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the three largest tech companies in the world, if you think about it, you've got TikTok, Snapchat, LinkedIn, all of whom have picked in the last 5 years Farringdon as their UK HQ. But we get a lot of West End migrants coming over.
I was going to ask about that. We do a lot of work in the West End, and we constantly hear the lack of new office supply in the West End is forcing people to move out. The rents are going crazy. There's not much new stuff being built. Are we seeing, and it always struck me, but if Google's going to King's Cross, and if you said all these other companies are going there, the ecosystem that feeds off of those companies or feeds into those companies would surely gravitate out of traditional Soho West End and move to the fringe.
Yes, but I think this is where there's a slight misconception. So that narrative, I think, is maybe 12, 13, 14 years outdated. So when I first started working in Farringdon a long time ago, the local amenity for my lunch was the local Tesco, right? Now you look at Farringdon, it's a to be fair, all of the locations that we've mentioned, they are properly established
locations. They've got their own identities, don't they?
They've got their own identities. They have a specific kind of culture. I think the way I tried to describe the City Fringe compared to the West End, and I love, by the way, I'm a lover of London generally. I love Canary Wharf. I love the City of London. I love the West End. I love the Fringe. They've all got something different to do. But the way I kind of describe the City Fringe compared to the West End is super busy. It's in some places, it's chaos. I mean, even on in a working week, you try and navigate your way down Oxford Street or Regent Street. It's chaos with office workers, tourists, so on and so forth. But everything in the West End is quite obvious. You know where the best restaurants are. You know where the best streets are. The City Fringe is a bit more uncovered. You've kind of got a, kind of, if you know, you know. It's kind of a bit of a journey of discovery, if you like. It's got all the amenities. It's got great gyms and great hotels and great bars and great restaurants and great sandwich places. But it's all a bit more spread out, a bit more relaxed. We don't have to push people out the way to get from A to B.
Yeah.
And then you kind of compound that with the, as you said before, the introduction of Crossrail. It's just changed the game. Crossrail has changed the game. I mean, I got here from my office. So we're in Whitechapel today. My office is in Farringdon. From leaving my desk to walking in this door was about 13
minutes.
Incredible,
isn't it? Incredible. Insane. And is there enough supply of new office stock to meet the demand at the moment?
At the moment, there is plenty of supply.
Right, really?
There is plenty of supply and there are issues with demand. But it's interesting, right? And this is a false narrative that's, I mean, you're probably, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but you're probably seeing the Sunday Times talking about massive shortage of West End offices or city offices, right?
Yeah.
Rubbish. And it is rubbish. Now, well, it is rubbish for the majority of the market. Now, if you are building a best-in-class city tower or you are building a spectacular West End development of scale, you're in a great space because there is a shortage of big product coming through. There are issues with planning, with viability, with all the...
So the HQ office buildings, if you like. There's not many big,
Now that, but that only really represents the top slice.
Yep.
And if you're a big occupier, if you're a law firm, and you're looking for say 150,000 square feet in 27, 28, you haven't got that many options.
Yeah.
But if you want 5, 10,000 square feet on a floor today, you've got.
I think I saw there's no HQ buildings being completed in 29.
It's a major problem. Yeah. But this is a combination of factors. It's, listen, I think the fact that interest rates are where they are, cost of capital is insane. Obviously, that impacts capital values and yields. The cost of construction obviously skyrocketed. Everyone thought it was going to come down.
Yeah.
If anything, it's still going up.
Yeah.
So you can. There is real issues around scheme viability. But the narrative that I keep having to correct people on is, yes, there is a shortage of supply. But that's quite a dangerous statement to make when it only reflects the real top end of the market.
The top 1%, so to speak.
As I said, if you want to find offices today, and I'm not just talking about the City Fringe, I'm talking about in the City Core and even in the West End, you want 5 to 10K, there's no problem.
So how is it the market in terms of serviced offices versus unserviced?
Interesting question. So historically, a bit like kind of the political parties, you had the kind of the far left and the far right. So if you just kind of work with me for a second, you had convention at one end of the spectrum, you had serviced offices at the other end of the spectrum. There was never really an occupier that was kind of considering both.
Yeah.
It just never really happened. You were either a conventional occupier or you were a serviced occupier. That was kind of the status quo. What's happened, and it all started with WeWork, and whether you love or hate WeWork, you have got to respect what they did because they have rewritten the rule book. They dropped about 4 million square feet into the central London market of pre-fitted cool space with this kind of mad culture, and everyone was kind of lapping it up. It was at that moment that the conventional market, they couldn't do deals because everyone who was going out was going into WeWorks because everyone was kind of falling into this, this is great.
Guilty as charged. We've been in 4 different WeWorks. Guilty as charged.
Well, there you go. So what's happened is over the last kind of number of years is, if you take my political analogy, you've had the conventional market go very centre. So the conventional market are now delivering fitted spaces.
Yep.
So tenants like you don't need to put your hands in your pocket.
Yep.
Great. they are no longer demanding long-term commitments, and they're prepared to be much more flexible. So they've come competing, they've gone more centre. Mm-hmm. As a result of them going more centre, the service office world has also gone more centre. Yeah. So what you've now got is you've got two historic industries that, well, the same industry, but different parts of it, operating at different ends of the spectrum, and now they're both all in the middle, challenging for the same business. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that, and listen, we have a service office brokerage, I have a lot of clients in the service office industry. I am concerned for the service office industry at the moment. Mm-hmm. The majority of the service office operators, they're operating on a wholesale retail structure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah,
and what I mean by that is Mr. Service Office brand will go and rent a building from a landlord.
Yep.
They will rent that building for what they believe is a wholesale price, and they will then trade it out at a retail price, and they will make their margin. Yep. The landlord, it's a freehold-backed model. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I'm generalising here. There are obviously service office companies that have freehold models.
Yep.
There's also management agreement scenarios, but I'm just talking generally. Mm-hmm. So whereas when the market turns, the conventional landlord, he can be like, do you know what? We wanted £65 a foot. Do you know what? We're going to cut our cloth accordingly. We just want to get this thing let. We'll live to fight another day. We'll let it for 50.
Yeah.
They haven't got that wholesale retail argument. But all these service office operators that are holding leases at what they believe to be wholesale rents, they can't do retail big reductions because they'll end up be loss making. Now, that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
That is a big problem. And that problem has been exacerbated because the difference in product between a service office product and a conventional product today, they're basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Now, you're in a serviced office.
Correct.
I think you mentioned.
Yeah, we work Minster Court.
Before.
Yeah.
And I get it, right? For you, you're in, I don't know, how many people are you?
19 of us.
19 of you. So you're probably in a very small space in terms of the 19. Mm-hmm. You've obviously got all the facilities.
All the facilities and amenities, yeah.
And what's interesting is what we're finding through our data is that businesses, and again, the other problem is the conventional market, they're up in their game.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So whereas a conventional building of old, you kind of walk in, say hello to the receptionist, disappear upstairs. But now conventional lands are prioritizing amenity for occupiers. So it's business lounges, it's roof terraces, it's communal spaces. Mm-hmm. So all of this is just adding additional pressure onto the service office market, who fundamentally they need to be selling at big retail prices because they've got their wholesale price to pay back. So it's a problem.
And the service offices are facilities are popular because some would argue you have to attract people working from home to come back to the office.
Mm-hmm.
How have you seen, you've been quite outspoken on people coming back to the office and you think that's the right place to be. And I broadly agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I think Fridays, but Monday to Thursday, broadly agree with you.
Yep.
How are you seeing that shift when you're renting out space? Is it based on everyone being in there 5 days a week? Has it changed the rental model? Has it changed rents because people are only there 3 days a week?
No.
How's that shaken down in the City Fringe?
Well, I can talk from a London perspective.
Yep.
It's all nonsense. So during the whole COVID thing, there was this whole people have to pay for 3 days a week rather than 5 days a week. The reality is, and if you look at the stats that a lot of our clients get from their speed gates or their door entry systems, I mean, yes, Fridays and Mondays are slower. There is no denying that.
Yeah.
My personal views are it's a nonsense, but you know what? Everyone's entitled to do what they want to do. But what we are finding from a trend perspective is there hasn't really been any major impact on how people are taking space.
Right.
And what's really interesting is in the early days in a post-COVID environment, there were a lot of companies that did do that.
Yep.
They took maybe 20% less, 30% less than they needed. And lo and behold, fast forward 2 years, and they all of a sudden haven't got enough space. So COVID was a moment in time. The world was upside down. No one knew what was happening. Everyone was speculating.
Mm-hmm.
As we sit here, what, 4 and a bit years on? Listen, the world, we have not gone back to where we were in terms of operationally, market kind of consistency, market activity. But what I would say is that what COVID has done is it's made landlords improve their product, which has created a better environment for the consumer, the office tenant, to have better options. So for all the bad that COVID did, and it did do lots of bad for the property market, it's also enabled developers and providers to up their game and provide a better offering.
One of the submarkets that does appear to have been impacted more than any other, possibly by post-COVID, is Canary Wharf. How do you see Canary Wharf? We constantly read, again, you refer to the Sunday Times, and that is where I get my news from. And it does appear to be the HQ building occupiers from Canary Wharf are moving over to the city, and the city are certainly boasting about their attractions, and it does seem to be doing well. How do you see Canary Wharf?
All right, so before I answer that, what's really interesting is during the whole COVID chaos, everyone was like, no one's going to want to work in the city anymore. Everyone's going to, if they're going to take an office, it's going to be closer to where they live, shorter commute, blah, blah, rubbish. If anything, it's gone the other way. Businesses are prioritising the best buildings in the best location. So actually what people thought and what's happened is the complete reverse. Canary Wharf, I love. Genuinely, I've been on record, but I truly love Canary Wharf. I was there last weekend with my kids, go boating around in all the waters. It's got fabulous restaurants. It's got fabulous amenity. I mean, it literally is, it's safe, it's clean, it's it's got great transportation. It's brilliant, right? But it's got a problem from an office perspective. Yeah. But it's not just Canary Wharf. It's that whole kind of, so you've got the city fringe that we've been talking about, and then you've got this kind of eastern arc that goes around the city fringe, which is Greenwich and Canary Wharf and Stratford and Bromley by Bow and Hackney Wick and all, and there is so much office development. I mean, you drive around places like Hackney Wick and it is just board after board after board of buildings being built. Planning policy is a disaster because the likes of Hackney and they keep forcing developers to deliver offices, but it's a nonsense because there's not really that much demand. Now, I think Canary Wharf is going to be fine, right? Canary Wharf is, it's had a few bits of bad news with some big occupiers moving out, but it's also had some big occupiers commit to it. But I just feel it's too good to fail. Like the offering is too good to fail. I think the introduction of Crossrail, I think it's going to be fine. It's all the other buildings, all the other districts around it that don't have that level of amenity, don't have the transport infrastructure. And the problem is you've got people building buildings, and as going back to what I was saying before about construction costs, they need to build these things and make profit. And listen, property is a very simple economic structure. It's supply versus demand. If there is more supply than there is demand, pricing can only go one way. And the problem is at the moment is in that kind of eastern arc, and there are a few exceptions to that, but in that eastern arc, there is just too much supply. And there's not enough demand.
It always strikes me when you drive around is how much empty space there is on the ground floor. What do we do with that empty ground floor space? So much is boarded up and
so much of it. Yeah. But I mean, listen, I think for example, British Land are doing a phenomenal job at Canada Water, and I do think that will be a really big success because they're creating an ecosystem. But I mean, there are, I mean, if you drive over the flyover by, if you go to City Airport is a better example. And I love City Airport.
It's the best kept secret. Don't tell people about it. It's in no way.
It's like a bus. It's like a bus terminus. It's the best. But when I travel from City Airport and I'm in a taxi there and I'm driving through and I'm on all these A roads and I'm seeing, 100,000 square feet of offices there. I'm like, that's never letting. No. And then you drive past another one and then another one and another one. I'm like, who's renting these buildings? Especially in a post-COVID world where everyone is, I mean, businesses are hell-bent on getting their teams back. They're not going to be able to do that if they've got substandard offices. They're definitely not going to be able to do that if they've got awfully located offices. So who's going to rent these things? Who is? And then it goes on further. It's how do you recruit the best talent if you've got a crap office in a crap location? So I think, and the problem is, and I don't want to single out councils so I can get hate mail for it, but the problem is the way my understanding works on planning is the planning policy that we're working with today is something that was probably crafted 5, 6, 7 years ago. And it's just, these things should be reviewed annually. And not only should they be reviewed annually, but they should have people on those panels that actually understand the market. So there are multiple things we're involved in at the moment in the borough of Hackney. And by the way, there are pockets of Hackney that are super popular.
Yeah.
There are pockets of Hackney where you will not do office deals. You just won't do them. Yet the planning office, or the planning officer, is demanding that they deliver offices. Yeah. Now, I get it, because they're reading, the computer says, no, this is what the policy says. But if we want to have an incredible capital, which is diverse and vibrant and full and busy and successful, we've got to be a bit more nimble in the way we approach planning. And it can't be 5 years. You can't be looking at something 5 years ago, because the game changes all the time.
Yeah, it does need to be regular reviews. And we've got the London plan being reviewed at the moment.
I know, but how long's it been being reviewed for? And then when it's reviewed, how long's it going to take to do? And then the problem is, once they do it, it's going to be out of date again.
And there'll be new government policy and so on, and it just keeps cycling.
I mean, we were talking before, we started about the lack of residential, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we know that there is a shortage of affordable homes in London, right? We know that. Yeah. But policy at the moment is, I mean, how many schemes are you dealing with that are unviable?
Vast majority.
Yeah, I mean,
we are hardly working on any residential.
I valued a site, a mixed use site, the other day in Hackney, which is currently being used as a surface mounted car park. It's just a bit of land. I valued it as sub minus £3 million. Mm-hmm. Minus £3 million. It's worth more than, so this block, which has got, I don't know, 15 or so thousand square feet of offices, I think it was like 25, 30 flats. It's worth more as overground car parking.
Incredible, isn't it? In London.
In London. It's nuts. London. And that's because we've discussed construction costs. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. We've discussed interest rates, obviously, from a yield perspective and exit. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. But it's also the red tape around planning. It's the policies. It's nothing is working, and it's all going to grind to a halt. Mm-hmm. But it probably has already.
Yeah,
I mean, nothing's being built.
No,
really.
Not much residential going on, is there? But one thing I love about the property industry is the optimism, because property developers at heart and everyone who works in it, we have to be optimistic, because there is so much bad news, but it's always property developers who drive things forward. Over the cycle of starting something to finishing it, you've probably gone through two economic cycles. You could have Brexit, COVID, everything like that. So my hat off to the property industry. So where do you see the optimism?
I know I've been sitting there moaning, but I'm allowed to moan and be optimistic at the same time. And listen, put it this way, in the last 10 years, 15 years since running business. Well, I set up my first business in the middle of the financial crisis. Yeah. I set up my second business in the middle of the COVID crisis. Mm-hmm. Listen, I think property is an incredible industry. To work in it is brilliant. I don't think anything is drastically going to change. I think that we have a problem at the moment in consumer confidence and investor confidence. So I think there are lots of different things going on in the world at the moment. We've got, there's been inflationary issues. Yeah, they've got two, maybe three wars going on.
Yeah. Every day you open the paper, so to speak, and it's something new.
And listen, everything, it's a very kind of sentiment-driven industry. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a story. So, and there was a present I wanted to buy myself, right? Mm-hmm. I've been looking at this particular item. It's an expensive item. I've been eyeing it up for like 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. And about 4 or 5 weeks ago, I was like, do you know what? I might go and run over my bus tomorrow.
Yeah,
I'm going to do it. It will make me happy.
Did you check with the wife first?
No.
No, okay. That's brave.
No. Mm-hmm. I might want to be my own man. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm going to buy it. And then I think it was that Monday or Tuesday, I was like, right, today's the day. And it was the day that the Trump thing happened. Mm-hmm. The Trump tariffs, the stock market
tariffs blew up. Just blew up, yeah.
And then, obviously, I run a brokerage, and all of a sudden, I'm getting my WhatsApp from the team. It's going, this one's pulled out. This one's put on hold. Yeah. This one's pulled out. And I'm sitting there thinking, whoa, 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 whoa. Do you know what? I know I was going to do this thing today, but we've just lost about 7 deals in a day.
Mm-hmm. Hold off, mate.
I'm going to hold off. Yeah. And if you translate the way I behaved about me purchasing an item to a consumer who is about to rent an office, or an investor who wants to invest in a building...
Yeah.
If you're in a market where there is so much uncertainty and you have the opportunity to buy something on a Monday that could be worth less on the Friday, your natural instinct is just to hold fire.
Yeah.
And I think at the moment, everything is just boring, right? And like the property industry is boring at the moment. Yeah. It's not falling through its backside, but it's not firing
it's
through.
It's ticking along.
It's bumbling along.
Right.
Okay. I wish it was ticking along.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not ticking along. It's bumbling along. And yes, there'll be the odd deal in the West End for telephone numbers, and yeah. that's great. But again, we're talking about the real top slice. Mm-hmm. For most people in the property industry, whether you're an agent, whether you're in debt, whether you're a developer, whether you're an investor, mm-hmm. whatever you're doing, it is just bang average. It's mm-hmm. bumbling along. So what I think needs to happen mm. is we need to try and get some comfort. I'm not worried about the work from home thing anymore. At one point, I was like, this is the end of offices, yeah, yeah, but yeah. that lasted about on. 3 days on. And yeah. that's gone. People are coming back to the office. Mm-hmm. It's not just me saying it, it's fact. Yeah. But what I do think needs to happen is I think the world generally just needs a bit of stability. Mm-hmm. It feels like we kind of go from crises to crises at the moment. And I just feel if you, again, take consumer behaviour, like I gave you that example, mm-hmm. and you translate that into how people look at offices or moving home, it's the same thing. But yeah. we need some sustained stability so people can kind of feel good about themselves and confident.
It's a good job we've got 3.5 years of President Trump ahead of us to provide that
Listen,
stability.
So whether you love Trump or hate Trump, right, and I flip-flop between mm-hmm. kind of really, I won't say I love him because it's a very difficult man to love. Mm-hmm. I do respect the fact that he is being very bold in certain mm-hmm. approaches, some of them approaches I don't agree with. But I don't think Trump is necessarily the problem. If anything, I'm not saying I'd want Trump being mm-hmm. the prime minister of this country, but I just feel there's kind of a lack of, listen, it all stems from the top. The culture in our business and it stems from the people at the top, it feeds down. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the government, it's at the moment, I just think it's uninspiring. Mm-hmm. It lacks direction.
Needs a jolt of energy, doesn't it?
And it just doesn't give people the confidence. Like if the people at the top
yeah.
are bumbling around and not being confident, that is going to just directly impact the people underneath it, mm-hmm. like you and I.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't feel something massive needs to happen. Mm-hmm. I just feel we need some sustained calmness yeah. for a bit, which I don't feel like we've had. I said we've gone from we've bounced from
Brexit on. It's been
the financial crisis. Literally, it's yeah. just from one chaos
yeah.
to another. We had a bit of a run between the financial crisis and Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
We had what yeah. 5 years?
5 years?
Yeah,
yeah. 2010, Cameron government came in.
Yeah.
It all settled down a bit. And that's,
correct.
And have your own views on the policies, but it did settle down.
Correct.
And then Brexit.
So that's what I think needs to happen. As I said, it's not falling through the floor.
Yeah.
But it's not shooting to the moon. It's just boring mm-hmm. and bumbling along. And it's been like that for a couple of years now, really.
We started this by you saying you were doing fresh things in the industry mm. when you started off. So how do you make it not boring? How is Compton going to kick ahead for the next 2-3 years? What are you going to do to make yourself not be... Because I guess almost you're not the challenger brand anymore in many respects. If you think City Fringe, there's a couple of agencies I'd think of.
Yeah.
We did for Streddons and it was yourselves. So it could be a young upstarts looking at you thinking, right, they're there for the taking. No, so how are you going to stop that?
I would love that.
Yeah.
So the thing I love most about business is having competition.
Yeah.
And do you know what? You moan about the competition always. Mm-hmm. Make you do better things. It drives you on to do more. If we had more time, I'd tell you a story. Maybe on the mm-hmm. follow-up, I'd tell you a great story about when we were Hatton. We had some of the biggest firms come after us.
Yeah.
And it created this war mentality that
yeah.
was incredible. Listen, I've got big ambitions mm-hmm. for Compton together with my partners. Phase one of our project is kind of now complete. Phase mm-hmm. one was about building solid foundations. You can't build a rooftop extension without having solid foundations. So without kind of going into too much detail, mm-hmm. I feel that, listen, I think Compton as a business, it's not only got a brand, which means something, mm-hmm. Which is alternative to, I guess, a lot of the other brands of the market. But more importantly than the brand is the mindset, the way of thinking. It's we're all about challenging convention. Mm-hmm. And even though we've kind of hit a certain level, that is a constant challenge that we want to keep evolving. So don't be surprised if you see some interesting growth opportunities mm-hmm. within the Compton brand over the next kind of 3 to 5 years.
That's it. And maybe we'll be seeing it on Netflix.
And maybe you'll see it on Netflix.
Brilliant, Sean. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.